And now, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
I'm sitting in a different place in the room, and I'm thinking maybe my speaker is out or something, but I guess we're still working on the volume. Give me a thumbs up, Joe, if you're going to get this fixed. Okay. Tomorrow is the Meininger's 29th wedding anniversary, so congratulations to you both. And Mr. Meininger decided on his anniversary to drive to California to a church camp. Why don't we chat about this later? I've been married almost 43 years. It took me about 29 years to get that right, too, so no, just kidding. Toward the end of the movie, The Bucket List. Remember The Bucket List? How many of you saw The Bucket List? Okay, good, a few of you. All right. I'm going to ruin it for the rest of you that haven't seen it. Not really. Morgan Freeman's character. You know Morgan Freeman, great voice. He's leaving, it seems like a recording, or it's a written letter, but he voices it over this letter that he's written to Jack Nicholson, his newfound friend in the past year or so. And he tells him one last thing he'd like him to do for himself and for Morgan Freeman as a result of their friendship is to find the joy in your life. I hope that doesn't spoil the movie for you that might like to see it. But I'd like to ask you the question. Have you found the joy in your life? My parents came out of the Depression and World War II. They grew up during those times, and I'm pretty sure that for their young lives, going through the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s, that they didn't have a whole lot of joy present in their lives, just by the physical circumstances. My dad was born in 1918. My mom was born in 1927. So they lived through some of the roughest times of the 20th century. A lot of us have lived through some of the greatest times of the 20th century, some of the most prosperous times, but the times that they grew up in were hard and tough, and you had to struggle. And I think of the greatest generation, it's been said that those folks were survivors, and boy, oh boy, they brought that mentality into our childhood as well. Each day was like surviving. It was kind of like hand-to-hand combat. Having enough food, scrambling and scraping for this. And so I think that under the kind of physical circumstances that they grew up, you can understand now, we had good times as a family. I don't mean to paint the bleak picture of, you know, being so austere and everything and nobody laughing, everybody being kind of deadpan and, you know, just bleak. But I think you can see that in some cases it's tough for people to experience joy in their lives. I think sometimes, not always, okay, but sometimes joy has been a commodity in the Church of God that is rare. And it shouldn't be rare. I mean, we should have the greatest joy, as I'll try to explain today in the sermon, of anybody in the world. I was a student ambassador college, and one of the instructors that we had in Big Sandy was one of the earlier students in Ambassador College in the 1950s, Dean Blackwell. And he was our primary instructor in theology for our senior classes and speaking, and really great guy. Really had a lot of great opportunity to work with him and go out in the Sabbath down to Nacogdoches, Texas, and to Texarkana and various places within a 100-mile radius of Big Sandy and lead songs or give a sermon at when I was a senior. And he told us one time that in the 1950s, he and a number of other students had decided on a Saturday night they would go out to a movie. And it was a small college in the early 50s, okay, very, very small. And the students decided to ask Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong to go out with them after the Sabbath. And they politely declined because Mr. Armstrong was going to work on a telecast, not a telecast, but a broadcast. We did have a telecast in the 50s for a short time, but the broadcast or work on an article. And, you know, I'm sometimes wondering if joy was an element that could have been more present in Mr. Armstrong's life just simply because of what he chose to do. He was trying to build and build and build the church, the college, the work, the broadcast that was going on that was growing and growing and growing. And Mr. Armstrong was nearly 80 years old when I first met him as an 18-year-old, and he was like in his late 70s, may have been 80 years old in 1972, on a Friday afternoon in August in Bricketwood, England, as he welcomed into freshman class. And he was single-minded. He was single-minded. Everything was about the church. Everything was about the work of God. And up until his dying day, his concern was for the people of the church itself, and the work that needed to be done. Mr. LaRavia has shared with me, and others have told me, that, and I could see it as a, you know, even for many years as a field minister, that Mr. Armstrong's whole life was devoted to the church. But I'm sure that even he too could have probably found some more joy in his life. I started to attend church services in late of 1971. I didn't realize it at the time until January 7th, 1972, the first Sabbath of January. And the minister stood up and said, "Well, last night I tore up all my charts, my time charts, and threw them away. I guess that didn't happen." It was the 1975 syndrome, which is going to sound strange to a lot of you, but there was a feeling that perhaps, maybe, the church would have fled and been gone by 1975. We had a booklet called 1975 and Prophecy, you may remember, was published first in the 1950s. And there was the idea that possibly that could be a date, the church would be gone. And so at that particular time, I realized something that I hadn't. I was wondering, what's he talking about, time charts and, you know, chronological things and whatever, and talking about Christ's return. But that was a syndrome that kind of was flourishing, at least a little bit. Those of you who've been around for a while will have to acknowledge it was a part of our legacy. And if that's the way you're feeling, no matter what your age, it's kind of hard to find a lot of joy in your life in the present circumstances that you're living now, because you're looking over your shoulder waiting for the great tribulation to begin. Not a joyful time. The Bible shows us that, obviously. I wrote in the World News and Prophecy Review newsletter this past week that, in my opinion, we live in a very open time. We live in a time of great freedom, great religious freedom. It's a confusing time as well, but at least for us, we have the opportunity to celebrate the Sabbath, to keep the feasts of God, and to do a lot of things that in prior times, people of God have not had that much an opportunity. Around the beginning of the 21st century, I began to realize that we may have many more years ahead of us, all the while realizing that the incumbency of keeping God's laws and remaining true to the faith that has been once delivered is a part of our legacy, it's a part of our heritage, and it's something that we always must do. But as I read some of the writings of some of the authors at that time, people with some insight in a worldly way, Dinesh D'Souza, other authors, they talked about the American century and they talked about how great America was. And it appeared to me, and it wasn't like I'm right about this or anything like that, but it was true that God hadn't removed the entirety of his blessings, and he still hasn't. Still have a ways to go. I don't know how much further, but from a standpoint of the continuing presence of the United States in the world and the power that it exerts economically, militarily, socially, not all that good sometimes, it's still the United States that's on top in the world. It's just that way. I mean, you can't figure it any other way. So I had to adjust my thinking. Maybe that had taken place even prior to the 21st century. Maybe you did. Maybe you have. Maybe you didn't need to. I don't know. But it doesn't really matter now. No matter what the time or the circumstances, as we see today, no matter how young or how old you are, you have a duty. And Morgan Freeman gave it to you, even if you didn't see the movie. Well, I'm just using the movie and using that line. It's a pretty emotional line at the end. Go find the joy in your life. Is God concerned with your happiness and joy? I think the question answers itself, but the title is Finding Joy in Your Life. The Bible is our guidepost to finding joy in our life. Turn to Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9. Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. They're temporal, mixing temporary and temporal together. They're brief. They're very brief. So the instruction, a lot of it in Ecclesiastes is for young people, but it doesn't have to be limited to them. Now, why should they be the only ones that have the fun in life, right? Why should they be the only ones that have joy? Well, I wish that this particular topic had been preached a little bit more in my youth in the church and to a lot of people, but we were on the gun lap constantly and continually. We were going to Ambassador College to prepare to finish the work and get the word out to the rest of the world and complete everything, finish the prophecy of Matthew 24 and verse 14. We were urgent, and all of that is good, and we still continue in that, and that's good and right and appropriate, but I think lost along the way was some of the joy that human beings ought to experience, especially church members. In the 1960s and the 1970s, some of you who are new, okay, you may not remember this. You may not have known it was going on. 1960s and the 70s, if you were young, pre-college, if you were a teenager at that time, you'll know what I'm talking about, because one of the biggest questions that young people had at that time was that, are they going to have enough time in this physical life to be able to do the things that other generations have done, that their parents have done, and other people have done, like go to college or get a job or get married and have a family and have a good career? Believe it or not, that was a thing. That was something that was of concern. People growing up in the church, I'm talking about what we would term second generation Christians, people that had grown up in the church. It affected my wife to a certain extent. She's the source of my information on this. No, I'm kidding. I remember one time in Minehead in 1972 at the Feast of Tabernacles, one of the ministers gave a sermon. I don't think we had youth sermons in those days, but he gave a sermon directed to the young people and said, yeah, I know this is a really big concern, but whatever happens, God's going to take care of you. You see, he couldn't rule out the fact that they might not have that opportunity before Christ would return. But that was a thing. Church published an article, some of you may remember it, in the Worldwide News in the 1980s, that maybe going to college is not such a good idea, because these colleges in the world, they're worldly, and they have problems and dangers and all of that sort of thing. Man, there's some truth to that. Mr. Meininger is an educator, has to work within the system, right? Politics involved. You navigated it, right? You did it. A lot of people here have gone to college. But the overriding thinking of delaying or not doing something because the world is bad is really, we found, not great logic. There are a lot of skills and abilities and trades that can be enhanced in life which don't require a college degree. We've learned that too. There's honor in all work, and people can advance and develop without going to college. And I think that probably there's a lot of college that is, frankly, kind of useless. And I went to Worldly College. I went to Ambassador College. But we realize that it's, you know, not like my parents' generation. It was like, you got to go to college or else. I mean, my dad hated college men when he was when he had just gotten out of the military and when he had just come out of a world where they used to make fun. His brother-in-law and his brothers told me they used to make fun of people that went to college because they just didn't believe in it. You know, it was all stuffy to them. But then when we were growing up, boy, the tables turned. It was kind of a century-like tradition began to be incumbent upon all young people. Boy, you got to go to college to be successful. And you really didn't, and you really don't. But one of the themes of the book of Ecclesiastes is, as you know, the temporal nature of life. It's very brief, 70. Sometimes more than that. No matter what you at your age, I encourage you to read the book of Ecclesiastes. We won't spend all our time there today, but I encourage you to read this book and apply some of the lessons. I'll give you some guide points as well, because the book of Ecclesiastes can be one of the books that you can use to find joy in your life, real joy. And maybe the movie, The Bucket List, isn't necessarily an authoritative source for the wisdom of life, but I think it does convey an accurate lesson. And if you go find the joy in your life, live your life to the full, then maybe someday you can be buried in a coffee can up in the Himalayas somewhere. Did I spoil the ending for you? What are some of the most important aspects of your life? Well, God, family, your love life, your friends, these are things that people are concerned about. God would, for us, would be probably number one. I hope so. Family, the love of our lives, our friends, career, studies, personal advancement, possessions, wealth, people might call them. Solomon was a wealthy man. I think probably most of us have a better existence, more available to us than Solomon did. Pleasure, entertainment, rest, sleep, or any of those things. These are some of the topics that are covered in the book of Ecclesiastes. And again, one of the themes of Ecclesiastes, I think it occurs over, this word occurs well over 30 times in the book, is vanity. It's not the commonly accepted meaning that we have today. Vanity in this sense means vanity in what a lot of people think about. Vanity, they think of excessive pride, maybe pride in one's appearance, their achievements, their character, being self-concerned, but that's not what Solomon is getting at. He's talking about the temporal nature of life. It can also be interpreted as meaningless, temporary, useless. It's actually used 31 out of 35 times in the Old Testament, vanity appears in this book. So if in some people's opinion, looking through this book, they think that there's no use for any of these things that I've mentioned, any of the pleasurable things of life, career, family, love, job, wealth, but that's not the case. Where can you find joy in your life? Are any of these wrong? Let's take a look at the way some people have looked at the book of Ecclesiastes, and they've concluded that, if you'll turn to chapter 2, they've concluded that, it's just work. That's vain. It's all vanity. It's all temporary. Doesn't really matter. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 4. Solomon said, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. He accomplished a lot. In other words, I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. says, I acquired male and female servants. He was wealthy. I had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. And he said, it's all vanity. In chapter 5, in verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. Verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Some have interpreted these verses as saying, hey, don't aspire for these things. Don't try to find any purpose or joy in these things because they're vanity. Back to chapter 2. Should you be happy? No, that's vanity too. They say. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also is vanity. Happiness, mirth. Kind of an ancient term. We don't use it in everyday conversation, but I think you know what it means. I said of laughter, it's madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? He concluded that it was temporal, it was vain. So some conclude that if you try to find any meaning in this at all, that it's all vain. You'll come up empty, but that's really not the point of the book. You're missing the lesson if that's the conclusion you come to. In chapter 12 and verse 13, he says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter, everything summed up. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. This is the essence of joy. Jack Nicholson didn't have this as a lesson. Maybe had the comforting words of a friend that he met later in life, and he went about and he found what real joy was. And you can watch the movie and find out at the end what it is. But he did find some measure of joy, kind of in a physical way, but that's good too. But for those of us in the church, there is nothing wrong, as long as God is in your life, for having a family, wanting a family, wanting a great career, even going to college, if you do it the right way, having possessions or even wealth, or having the noble aspirations of a great career, there is absolutely nothing wrong with any of that. As long as you put this first, as long as you're fearing God and keeping the commandments of God, because that is the essence of joy. Chapter 2 and verse 24. Chapter 2 and verse 24, Solomon said, nothing is better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. And all labor is good. All jobs can be good, depending on your attitude toward it. Terry knows this story pretty well. I had a job. It wasn't really a demanding job from a physical sense, but I had a job one time. It was the second job I had in Austin, Texas, when we moved there after marriage. And something that her father had told me rang true for me as well. I'd spent a lot of time with Terry's dad in the summer of 1975 when I first was sent out to Corpus Christi as a ministerial trainee. And we'd ride around in the park, solve crimes. He was a park ranger. He's a police officer. He was a park ranger, but a police officer, and a couple instances in which he needed my advanced help to solve some petty thefts, etc. It's truth. I'm not going to tell the whole story. It is a true story. I just laugh at it. But anyhow, he told me about his career in the church, his coming into the church, some of the jobs that he had had after he had to leave the state police department because he was coming into the church in the early 60s, and that, like Mr. Tennert's profession of being a pharmacist, was one of those no-no things. You just couldn't do that. You couldn't be a police officer and be in the church. So he was handing out driver's license for the most part. So that was ruled to be not a good thing. So anyway, he said that there were jobs that he had that he absolutely hated to go to bed at night because he knew he'd have to get up in the morning and go to work. And that was the kind of job that I had, this second job that I had, not necessarily the demanding, but just kind of I was a square peg in a round hole. I had to get out of there and eventually did. But I couldn't enjoy my labor, and it just dawned on me after a while, you got to change the circumstances. You got to do it. You got to get yourself out of this thing, which with God's help, I eventually did. But it was one of those jobs. But all work can teach you something. All work is noble. And if you can enjoy your job, that's great. If you can't, it's up to you to find a way out with God's help. I don't care what you do for a living, but whatever it is, you should enjoy it. In the last couple of years, I've had the opportunity to speak to our young people at Feast of Tabernacles and Bible study and shared with them some of the things that I've kind of learned, trial and error, hit and miss throughout my church career, my business career, and certainly know that God wants you to be happy in where you spend at least a third of your life in working. If you're not happy, change the dynamic. I found that lesson, again, not through any great providence or inspiration, but boom, hit me like a 2x4. Chapter 3, here's a chapter that's about time. I don't care what your age is. I would be called a senior citizen now. One of the younger ones here. What does that say about you? This is a chapter about time, and it says that there's a time for every purpose and every season. You know that the birds put this lyric to melody. Maybe you didn't know that. Maybe you don't know who the birds are. Go find it. I'm not going to waste time on it. Verse 9 says, "What profit has the worker from that which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts. Except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. And I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor. It is the gift of God." Today, you have time on your side. You have time to rejoice. I don't know how long we'll go until the time of Jesus' return. And bad times are up ahead, but they're not immediate. And the lesson of Ecclesiastes is that you have time maybe to change the direction of life for yourself. I don't care how old you are. You can find joy in your life. I've told the kids, we got a great group of kids in the church. I'll tell you what, the last 2 years at the feast, when you get more of them together, a lot of them are motivated. They have goals. They have their life planned out. I've been very impressed. It's been eye-opening for me. There's been some good work done by the parents of these church kids. And I'm talking, when I say kids, I mean people in from 19 to 34 years old. They show up for the Bible study. That's impressive. They come to Bible study on a Tuesday morning during the feast at 9 o'clock, or they show up. One of them that I conducted at 6 o'clock in the evening on a Sabbath evening, a Friday evening, after dinner. We had like almost 40 of them come in Oceanside to a Bible study. I mean, that was really good. That was very comforting to see that. But it's very, very nice to see that kind of motivation among the young people in the church. And I'm sure that you have the same kind of, you see the same thing in the church kids at the camps which is great. But I've told the kids, you know, I finished kind of my work career in one industry. You're just beginning. You're going to have 40 years to work, but it's going to go by like that. So you better plan, and you better be thinking, because before you know it, those kids you never thought you'd had are grown up and gone away. They're off doing their own thing. It happens in like a flash. This is a chapter about time. Verse 22, I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? In chapter 5 and verse 12, you find that kind of occupation and work in life. There's a lot of joy in it. And it says, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. And I don't want to get rich. I won't be able to sleep. Be thinking about all my riches all night. Who's trying to take them from me? If you don't want to be rich and you have too much, I'm going to make you an offer. I'll take it off your hands just in the interest of keeping you happy. I'll safeguard it. I'll invest it mostly in my own life. You'll see dividends. You'll see me so happy. Just kidding. Verse 18, chapter 5. Here's what I've seen. It's a good and fitting for one to eat and drink, to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him. For it is his heritage. You know, that's what God wants you to have. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. You do it the right way. Not like I just said, taking wealth from you and keeping it for myself. No, you do it the right way. You work hard for it. And you put God first. You obey the command at the end of the chapter. Nothing wrong with wealth, riches, money, possessions. Using it for the glory of God. Nothing wrong. God allows you to have that. He's made it possible. For he will not dwell unduly in the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Chapter 8 and verse 15. Solomon says, so I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry, for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life. So if you ever catch yourself having a good time, don't feel guilty about it, as long as you're doing it according to God's law. If you're enjoying yourself, and you should, there's no reason to feel bad. You're doing the right thing. This is what is commended. Whether you're young or old, there is a need to find joy, to be filled with joy, with happiness. I know a lot of people who have fulfillment and joy on some level, but they don't have the potential that you do. If they're in the church, if they're not in the church of God, because with the plan of God, with eternity and time that God has put into our hearts, without that, life can be temporary or vain. It just goes by like that. God has put it in our hearts to want to be eternal. Chapter 11. In this chapter, Solomon explains the uncertainty of life. It's just the way the world is. Sorry, won't be like that in the world tomorrow. But the world is not your friend. My dad put it this way. Again, you know, coming out of the Depression, World War II. The world doesn't owe you a living. Anybody ever hear that one? Every week, we would hear that one. The world doesn't owe you a living. But what does this mean? Verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters. All I'm thinking about is the mental picture. You're out on a pond or you're at the seashore. You got a loaf of bread. You toss it in. Gets soggy and kind of melts away, you know, disintegrates. Well, that's not what it means, obviously. It's a picture here that is designed to encourage investment. The picture that some of the commentators think of is that Solomon is thinking about ports of entry, ports of departure, ships. You take some risk. You take some risk putting some cargo onto a boat, sending it off, and then the expectation you're going to be able to sell that cargo or that grain. Somebody else will turn it into bread, and they'll sell it, and both parties will be happy. But that's what this chapter is about. It doesn't happen immediately. You make investments when you're young, like maybe you make an investment in your education, or maybe you would make an investment in your trade, or maybe you learn how to do this better or that better. You make an investment in your physical life, and if you are good at calculating the risk, you'll get a return on it. And sometimes you have to diversify. You have to do maybe a number of different things, 7 or 8 things, as it says. You just don't know because of the world that we live in. It's not perfect. It's designed to be against you. Solomon saw this, and he's telling young people, you know, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. You have no idea where that's going to happen, he says. If a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it's going to lie. Sheer chance. Time and chance. You know, life is like that. You cannot predict the future. You can't predict what's going to happen. But the one thing Solomon says is that you can predict accurately that if you don't do something, if you're not active yourself, if you're not concerned at all, then nobody else is going to be. Because he who observes the wind will not sow. Oh, wow. Plow the field today, George? It's kind of windy out there. The seed's going to all blow away. Maybe it's still. No, I better wait for a better time. He who regards the clouds will not reap. I don't think it's going to rain this season. It would be a waste to sow that seed. You don't know. You can't predict. In other words, you got to take some action. You must take some risk, even if it's your own time. You don't know the way of the wind or how the bones will grow in the womb of her who is with child. We know a little bit more about that in this day and age, but you don't know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed. You know, don't hold back. Don't withhold. Don't be afraid of taking a calculated risk. And in the evening, do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. You know, both things you do might turn out for the better, but if you never try, you're never going to know. Verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart. You know, young people have an opportunity to determine. You know, it may seem like the space of time is not very long, you know, when you're a teenager and you're becoming a young adult. There's a time there in which not many people fit that category right now, but again, you can still apply it at any age in life. It's a time to find out what's going to work for you, where your talents are, where your abilities lie, as I've said before, and then go forward. God will bless you in that. All of these are good lessons to help us find joy and fulfillment in life. Read the whole book. We just covered a few passages, but Solomon makes it clear that with God in our lives, we can have joy in whatever we do. in the past, I think some made a mistake going back very, 30, 40, 50 years ago, thinking like the Thessalonica church did, hey, we better hold back here. Better hold back. It's not the time. Notice 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. You read these two books and the chapters in them in 2 Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians. They had a lot of great qualities, but it's obvious that there was one thing that was really on their mind. And maybe we should have learned this lesson as a church a long, long time ago. One of the things that was on their mind big time was the return of Christ, thinking it was going to be right then and there. And that's good to have. That doesn't mean stop doing. Paul makes that very clear. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6, they fell into some bad habits, some of those folks did. Not all. But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. Paul is saying it was disorderly. Now, some might think, you take that verse out of context like that, and you might think, they were breaking the law, they were doing something bad that we would consider bad, like sin. But that's not exactly it. He had set a tradition in going into that community and going into that area of supporting himself. He makes reference to the fact that, hey, I didn't have to do this. I'm the minister. You should pay me. I can collect tithes from you, but he didn't. He said, I've set a tradition for you. You're walking disorderly. He said, if you don't follow this, for you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. What does disorderly mean? It's coming up. Nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day. He made tents. He sold tents. He worked. He worked. He worked. So he says, I didn't become a burden to you. Not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. My dad said the same thing. The world doesn't owe you a living. I told you a story before. My brother turned 11. I was like, how old are we? I've been 7. First day of, I think it was 11. First day of summer vacation. It's 8 o'clock. We're sleeping in. Dad comes in, rouses my brother out of bed. What are you doing in bed? He says, well, it's the first day of summer, Dad. It's summer vacation. He said, get out of bed. Go find a job. He did. We didn't do that to our kids. Should have. No, just kidding. My brother got on his bicycled up into the Catoctin Mountains and found a job picking peaches in an orchard. Good for you, Hugh. I slept in. Played baseball all summer with my friends. It was a tough life. Paul got the message across to them that they needed to do some things. They needed to get to work, at least some of them. Turn to Leviticus chapter 23. There's a series in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that you can find, a series of passages that talk about rejoicing. And they all have to do with one single thing. Leviticus 23 is the Feast of the Lord chapter. And guess what it says? Leviticus 23 and verse 40, we read, and you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days, keeping the feast. In this case, the Feast of Tabernacles. You shall keep it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the 7th month. You shall dwell in booths. temporary dwellings. It was for the time. And have motels in. Had a lady one year, came to the feast in Rapid City, I think it was like 1981. She got a teepee. You know, we live in Sioux Country in the Dakotas. She figured this was the best representation of a temporary dwelling that she could find. She kept the feast in a teepee. Don't think the Indians ever got this message, by the way, but that's what she thought. Temporary dwellings. Today we go to the feast. Most of the time we stay in a house or a motel. We have a lot more understanding about what the feast means than they did, but they were to rejoice because the plan of God reveals salvation to us, beginning with Passover, covering of our sins, the days of unleavened bread, putting sin out, Pentecost, the receiving of the Holy Spirit, trumpets, the return of Jesus Christ, atonement, the binding of Satan. And afterwards, the Feast of Tabernacles, 1,000 years of peace and prosperity on the earth. The White Throne Judgment, a time when everybody else has an opportunity because there have been billions. Some people estimate 50 to 100 billion people have lived. If God doesn't make a provision for them, he's not very loving of his creation. But he has. And they'll be called to salvation at that time. For whatever period of time that is, or this, as the scripture indicates, possibly 100 years, it doesn't matter. They will receive their gift of salvation at that particular time. In Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 7, three times in this chapter, we're told to rejoice in keeping the holy days of God. Deuteronomy 12 and verse 7. It's one of the primary things that we're supposed to do at the feast, at any of the feasts. Deuteronomy 12 and verse 7. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, you and you shall rejoice in all which you have put your hand, you and your households, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. Verse 12, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion nor inheritance with you. Verse 18, but you must eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God chooses, you and your sons and daughters, your male servants and your female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all that you put your hands. Deuteronomy 14 and Deuteronomy 16 say similar things. I won't cite those. You can look them up. Find the word rejoice. You'll see it as associated with the holy days. These times are intended for our rejoicing. Good times, happy times. Now, they didn't understand what we do today, but at least God was at the center of their worship, and whenever these feasts were kept, Israel rejoiced. It wasn't much in their history. Over hundreds and hundreds of years before Israel went into captivity, and then another 120 or so before Judah went into captivity. They didn't really do it much, but in Nehemiah 8 and verse 12, they kept the feast after the captivity. The Jews kept the feast. They came back to Jerusalem, and it shows that they rejoiced because of what they heard. They read the book of the law, and they had it read to them, and they were so thankful, and they rejoiced. Through the co-worker letters of Herbert Armstrong, and we realized that in the early days, for at least seven years, when he discovered that the holy days, in addition to the Sabbath, should be kept, he brought this information to the Church of God Seventh Day in the Detroit, Michigan Conference in 1937, and it was rejected. So he went back to the little church in the Oregon Conference and asked the people whether or not they wanted to keep those days. And they all agreed that they should keep them. And it started out very, very small with about seven people. In the 1938 and 1939 co-worker letters, you begin to see through the writings of Herbert Armstrong that he was beginning to understand the meaning associated behind these commands. There is a clear trail, and there is a clear trail you can look for yourself if you get those letters, 1938, 1939, co-worker letters before the feast. I can get them for you. They began to see the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles, that it was associated with the thousand-year reign of Christ. Too much information to cover here, but it's very, very clear. Man, when you begin to see all of that and you realize, hey, not like me when I was a little kid in Sunday school and Lutheran church and thinking to my own little head, my own little brain, why does God allow all this suffering? But boy, when you understand that God has a plan for everybody, it should give you joy. And not only for yourself, but for everyone. No matter what happens, though, no matter where you are in life or whatever happens in the future, you can find joy in whatever circumstance you find yourselves in. The book of Philippians teaches us that. And you can read through the book of Philippians. I just want to cover a couple of points as I close here. You can find joy even in difficult times, okay? Not just good times like at the feast or, you know, in this present time, which I've tried to impress is a good time. These are good times, not bad times. We're not looking over our shoulder, waiting for the great tribulation and being sorrowful about all of that. No matter what your age, enjoy your life. Have joy. Enjoy. Be filled with joy because of the purpose God has given to you. But even if times get difficult, whatever the circumstances are, the example of God's servants show that you can be joyful despite those circumstances. Have you ever wished that you could go back and tell your younger self? No, you shouldn't do that. Maybe, you know, if you could just have a little private conversation with yourself when you're 16 or 17, you might want to alter that. You don't want to do that? Well, you can't do it. Of course, you know that if you did do that, you would alter the space-time continuum and it would ruin everything for everybody here in the present. So please don't do that, right? All the movies about time travel teach us that, correct? You don't want to change it. Like, you know, if a butterfly is killed in Australia, it's going to cause some catastrophic earthquake across the globe, right? No, it doesn't. But anyway, have you ever thought about that and what you would tell? I have. And I've tried to take some of those lessons and, you know, maybe I ought to start doing that now. Maybe I ought to realize that that's a lesson for me today. And it might be different for every single person. But there's a song that Kenny Chesney sang a few years ago. It's called A Lot of Things Different. It's not an endorsement of the song, but one of the lines is really interesting. It says, people say they wouldn't change a thing, even if they could. Oh, but I would. And that's what the song is about. I've heard people say, and sometimes even people in church, well, you know, I did this or this horrible thing happened to me, but I'm glad I did it. I'm glad it happened because if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be where I am today. Which is usually nowhere, but anyway, that's beside the point. I've even heard people be proud of some of the mistakes they've made because it led them to this. Well, okay, I don't really buy that line of reasoning. But one of the things that Solomon said is, the world is not your friend. You know, it's chapter 11. In Acts chapter 16... I'm just going to give you the narrative here. Acts 16, very interesting chapter. Paul picks up Timothy. They're thinking of going to Bithynia. But God says no. His spirit prevents them from going to Bithynia. Later on, through history and tradition, we learn that somebody else had already gone there, one of the other original disciples had gone there. There's no use in reproducing the effort. He's going to take a fork in the road. He's going to go up to the northeast. But apparently, maybe Peter or James, maybe others had been there. They rode up to that area of the world later on in their writings. So they were going to go there, but God said no. So in verses 8 and 9, they get a vision. Paul gets a vision of a man from Macedonia saying, come and help us. And so from where they are, where it'd be northern Turkey today, they hop on a boat the next day from Troas and they go over across. It's a day's sail. And they go over and they go to Macedonia. And then they preach. Paul casts a demon out of some girl. And they're thrown into prison as a result of all that because she's been kind of a soothsayer. People have been making money off of her as a medium and fortune teller. And everybody's upset and anxious. They throw Paul in prison. Supernatural thing happens, an earthquake. You know, the guard is about to impale himself because everybody's escaped. He's going to be held responsible. Paul says, no, don't do that. We haven't left. You know, all the shackles and chains, they could escape, but they didn't. The keeper of the prisoner is baptized. You know, these things take some time, but he asks questions. And so they go back to the brethren at Philippi. They meet Lydia, who's from Thyatira, which is a seller of purple. She learns. The church grows, to make the long story short. And then, about 10 years later, 61 or 62 A.D., Paul writes to those folks at Philippi. And now he's in Rome. And he's in chains. And he's either under house arrest or he's in a prison. But Paul makes the best of this whole situation of imprisonment. Now, in the book of Philippians, rejoicing is mentioned 9 times. It's mentioned more times in the book of Philippians than any other New Testament book except for Luke, where it's mentioned 11 times. Now think, Paul is talking about rejoicing. He's in prison. And we know that he eventually was killed. The tradition is that he was killed after 3 or 4 year imprisonment. So he was now in prison, but now he's telling people to rejoice. Notice, and you can look for all the instances of rejoicing, but in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 12, he says, I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. Now, this isn't like the incident that I told you earlier where people brag about things that they did that were wrong, but then it actually was a help to them, which I disagree with as a general idea. This is something that happened to Paul. He didn't bring it on himself, but now he was captive. He says, so that it has become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. People came along, were converted as a result of his imprisonment. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Yeah, it's turned into a good thing. In chapter 2 and verse 12, he says, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Now, joy is mentioned in the book 5 times. So the lesson is very clear. No matter what your circumstance today or in the future, you can build, you can find joy in your life. If something isn't working, like in some cases we got people around the globe that are separated from contact with other brethren, now's that opportunity. If you don't have a local church, if you don't have the opportunity to get together, if you're just listening on tape or watching from afar, you may have to work out your own salvation with not a resident minister around. It's just your lot in life. But it doesn't mean it's impossible. I mean, boy, if I can download Beyond Today and I can watch it on this phone, Well, you don't have my phone. I'm sorry for you. Too bad. But it's a joke. Most of you do. But you have access to the truth is the point. You can have joy in your life, but if something isn't working, whether it's physical or spiritual, evaluate it. Change it. Don't accept your lot in life. Joy, according to Solomon, is what you find in every endeavor in life. Your youth, your job, your family, pleasure, laughter, the feasts, all of those things we can find joy in. And Paul teaches us through Philippians that joy can be found no matter what the circumstances God allows. So for you, for now, go find the joy in your life.